Welcome back to our Exodus teaching. We're going to begin this evening with chapter 17. And chapter 17 tells of Israel's complaint of lack of water and the provision of water that came as a result of Moses striking the rock. According to 1 Corinthians 10:4, the rock that produced the water symbolizes Jesus who quenches our thirst. And a couple other references you might want to look up is John chapter 4 verse 10 and John chapter 7 verse 37. The smiting of the rock points to the provision that came as a result of the smiting of Jesus, his death, burial, resurrection. Chapter 17 also records the defeat of Amalek as a result of Moses, Aaron, Hur, and Joshua, each doing his part. All right. You ready for me to read verse 1?
Plodding,
right? Yes, sir. All the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin. After their journeys, according to the commandment of the Lord, and pitched in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink.
This seems to be a problem, doesn't it?
Yes.
When you think about the number of people and all the animals, everything that they have, it takes a lot of water to accommodate. And here again, you find whether or not the Israelites are truly dedicated to God. Do they trust God's guidance, God's leading? And you find that they don't. And it's the same way today. Do you trust God's guidance? And you understand that the cloud's leading them?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think God doesn't know some things, that he doesn't know where he's taking them, and he doesn't know the water and all that? But God's a supernatural God, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And God likes to show himself strong in our behalf. He just doesn't want to hear us complain. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And so here they are at Rephidim and no water. And so they're not happy.
Mm-mm. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said unto them, "Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord?"
So, you know, if you don't like the way things are going, just go to the leadership and just tell the leadership you don't like them. "I don't like the way you lead me. I don't like the way you're doing it." And Moses said, "Why do you confront me? The problem's not me. You think you're complaining against me? Talk to God about it. I'm just following the lead of God." And I'm going to tell you, we have to get to that point as ministers. If you're doing what God tells you to do, then don't be intimidated by what the people are saying. You continue to do what God's telling you to do. He's proven the people. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, "Wherefore is that that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst?"
Moses says, you're tempting God.
Uh-huh.
You understand? You tell him, "Why am I bringing you out here? And do you think I led you out here to die of thirst? I just followed God." And God, you think God led you out here to die of thirst? But all they can think about is themselves. Have you ever noticed this? Mm. Self-centered people are the complainers.
Mm.
God-centered people are not complaining. They may ask God a question, but they're not questioning God. You understand? Okay.
Wow. And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, "What shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me."
And so, you know, what do? The people are crying to you. You cry to the Lord, right?
Help.
And so the people are complaining to Moses. And Moses goes to the Lord about this thing. You know, people are ready to stone me. What am I supposed to do?
Mm.
He's not accusing God.
No.
Mm-hmm. He just needs some relief. Okay?
Yeah. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go on before the people, and take with you of the elders of Israel, and your rod, wherewith you smote the river, take in your hand, and go.
Now, this is interesting. So he says, you go before the people, you take with you the elders, the leadership of the nation, take the rod of God. Take that rod that you smote those waters, that river in Egypt, you take that with you.
Behold, I will stand before you there upon the rock in Horeb, and you shall smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel.
You know, God told him, right, gather the elders, and he told him where to go, and the Lord assured Moses that he said, I will go before you. Now, you can overlook this, but he said, I'm going to stand on the rock. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'll be there when you get there.
Yeah.
You're not going to get away from God. And so he tells, I'll stand on the rock. Now, what I want you to do is strike the rock with the rod of God. Mm-hmm. And when you do, water will come forth from it, and the people can drink. So Moses did as the Lord commanded. If you would read 1 Corinthians, chapter 10, verses, you can read verses 4 and 5 if you want to.
Verse 4. And did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness.
Now here's what I want you to see. Paul writing to the church of Corinth, he's saying that rock, in other words, Jesus was following them. He's not talking about a physical rock per se. But where does the water come forth from? That was supernatural. You with me? They got there, they couldn't find water. Moses hits the rock and water comes out. That's God. So God's producing the water. You remember at the woman at the well?
Mm-hmm.
The Samaritan woman?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus asked her for a drink. And why are you talking to me, a woman, a Samaritan? He said, if you knew who was talking to you, you'd ask me for a drink. I'd give you water that'll spring up to everlasting life. Oh, give me that water.
Yeah.
If I don't ever thirst again, I don't have to come to the well to draw. Let me have some of that. She's thinking naturally, you understand? But all this that we're reading is type pointing to Jesus who quenches your spiritual thirst. You understand? It will satisfy your spiritual hunger. And so the natural is pointing to what Jesus is going to do for us by the Spirit, okay?
We want y'all to remember this. We've got two test questions here that are I want y'all to take note of. The first one is the rock, and that's your key word, the rock in the wilderness that produced water is a type and shadow of Jesus, who is the sustainer of our lives. And then the second question is, according to 1 Corinthians 10:4, Jesus was the rock from which the water came forth in the wilderness. Jesus is key.
Now, I'll say this again, but later on in the study, this is why Moses got in trouble when he smote the rock the second time. He marred the type. Jesus was to be stricken one time. He was to be spoken to after that. You with me? So that'd give you a little insight into this. Jesus, the rock, just following them in the wilderness.
Verse 7. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, Is the Lord among us or not?
Massah means testing. Meribah means quarrel or strife. And so these Israelites, they think they're confronting Moses, but they're actually tempting the Lord, because here's what they said: Is the Lord with us or not? I didn't tell you, there's people today that are that brazen saying the same thing. And it's a dangerous place to be. That's not faith trusting in God. It's an accusation against God. And we're not in a position to be accusing God, I promise you that. So he's wanting us to trust him. The cloud said, come this way. Here we are. You wouldn't lead us where you're not providing for us. And so start thanking God for the provision, whether you see it or whether you don't. You start thanking God for the provision. Faith possesses without seeing.
Yeah.
And if you have to see it to believe it, you're not in faith.
Verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim.
So Amalek, here are these Amalekites, they come against Israel. You know, they don't have water. Now somebody's come to battle with them here at Rephidim. They think they're having a bad day, you understand. But God has a different plan.
And Moses said unto Joshua, Choose us out men, and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.
Rod of God, you get that?
Yeah.
And so Moses says, All right, Joshua, you understand, Joshua's the leader of the army. He says, All right, Joshua, I want you to take your troops, you select the troops you want to take, and I want you to go out against Amalek. You engage Amalek in battle. Now I'm going to go up here to the top of the hill, and I'll do my thing, and you do your thing, and we're going to be the victors, is the essence of it. Okay? Moses had a role to play. Joshua had a role to play. And a lot of times we don't understand that. We think all the responsibility is on one person. People think, well, you know, the pastor's supposed to do everything.
Mm.
You know, well, you've got a part you do too. He'll go up on the hill, you go out to battle. And he's going to cover you while you're in battle. That's what Moses is doing with Joshua, okay?
So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed.
So, what's Moses' role? Moses' role is to stand in the gap on the spiritual side. Hold my hand up. As long as my hand's up, what's happening? Joshua's winning. The Israelites are winning. In other words, when the leadership's right, and, you know, doing it, covering them, covering the army, then the battle is going in favor of the Israelites. But as we'll see here, this was an all-day deal. Have you ever tried to hold your hands up all day? Have you ever been in boot camp? You find out, you think you're conditioned, and you start holding out or running around with an M1 rifle up over your head or whatever, and you find out you're not near the man you thought you were. You can actually lose your coordination. You understand? You get so tired, and you better not let those arms go down. Moses' arms goes down, and Joshua starts losing the battle. You go ahead and read. I'm jumping ahead of you a little bit.
But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed upon his hands, the one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword.
You understand that Moses holding his hand up is a key to winning.
Mm-hmm.
But when his hands get tired and they start coming down, Amalek starts winning. And so, because Moses' arms are heavy, his hands are heavy, Aaron and Hur, they put a rock under him and get him positioned to where they can support his arms, to where his arms stay up. Now here again, you got to get a visual image of this. Number one, sitting on the rock all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, even Aaron and Hur, they have their work cut out too, just holding Moses' hands up. But because they did that, Joshua defeated Amalek. What happens if Moses' hands are down? The rod of God. This is the key. It's not just his hands, it's the rod of God. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
We have to keep the authority of God out there in the spirit world in order to win. And this is what Moses' role is. That rod of God is showing, this is a type, this authority. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Over the darkness. And so Joshua prevails. But here's what you need to see. I don't care what God's called you to do, you won't be able to do it by yourself.
That's good.
You have to have help. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Moses is a great man of God. There's no question about that. But Moses couldn't do it by himself. Number one, he needed Joshua and the troops to engage in battle. But then he needed to take his position, his role in representing God. But then even in doing that, he had to have support. You understand? And I can tell you that any ministry has to have support staff. You have to have people helping you. If you don't have people helping you, you're extremely limited in what you can do. No man is an island, and anybody that thinks he can do it by himself is already deceived. They can't do it. You need help. And we're going to find later on that there's wisdom in getting help. You don't wear yourself out, you don't wear people out. And when you have, but let me qualify this. When I say help, it has to be people with the same vision.
That's right.
You can't just say any old body come in, you take this, you take that. No, if they're not sharing your vision, they're going to hurt you.
Yeah.
If you're not with me, you're against me.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be thinking right. You have to have the same vision. Aaron and Hur are right there united with Moses. We're going to hold your hands up until this battle is won, and we won't quit, and you won't quit. And Joshua's not going to quit. Everybody's doing their part. That's extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question for you. The defeat of the Amalekites came as a result of Moses, Aaron, Hur, and Joshua each doing his part. Your key word is defeat.
All now, right. Go ahead. I'll interrupt you.
No, sir.
Now, after this battle's won, God speaks to Moses. Write this down.
Yes.
And you tell, you write it down, and you tell this to Joshua. That he knows what Amalek's done. And God says this, I will completely erase the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Now think about that. It's not just winning this battle. God says, no, I'm going to take care of Amalek. This is just one battle. You want to read 1 Samuel? Look at chapter 15, and just verses 1 through 3 will suffice. 1 Samuel 15.
Samuel also said unto Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, hearken unto the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus said the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass."
This is where you need to get all your scripture together, okay? And so God says, all right, Moses, write it down. You rehearse it. You tell it to Joshua. And this goes on the generation. He didn't say tell Joshua to wipe out Amalek.
No.
But you'll find even in the judges that they fought against Amalek. Now, when Saul becomes king, God speaks to the prophet Samuel, and he says, all right, go tell Saul, utterly destroy. Don't leave anything breathing. People or animals. When I say utterly destroy, what did God say? I'm going to blot his name out from under heaven. Now you can understand what Saul's error was. He's hindering what God wants done. God said utterly destroy. And God is not a negotiator.
Mm.
He gives a command and expects that command to be carried out. And Saul doesn't even kill the king. But Samuel takes care of business.
Oh, yeah.
You understand? God says destroy. Samuel destroyed. And a lot of times people think they have a better idea than God. You know, well, we kept the best so we can give sacrifices. And what does he say? Obedience is better than sacrifice. And to hearken than the fat of rams. What does he call that? When Saul disobeys, he calls it rebellion. When you don't do what God told you to do, you don't fulfill the assignment, you're in rebellion against God. God is going to keep his word. I'm going to blot out Amalek's name from under heaven. Now, don't interfere with that. Cooperate with it. That's what got Saul in trouble, and it cost him the kingdom as far as him, his descendants going becoming king after him because he disobeyed God in that he didn't destroy Amalek. The Amalekites.
The other thing we looked at today, and we talked about this, was the fact that the Lord said, rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. You write down this word, and you rehearse it in the ears of Joshua.
Yeah, it goes from, Joshua's going to be your successor.
Mm-hmm.
So you make sure that Joshua knows this. And obviously Joshua had passed the word along too. Judges,
right.
In the era of Judges, they were fighting against Amalek. And then this thing comes to the fruition when Saul becomes king. All right, get rid of them. Wipe them out.
Right.
I don't want to fool with them anymore. You with me?
When we keep these, the faithfulness of God before us, these supernatural acts that he did for us, for the people, when they keep it before their eyes, then they don't fall into the trap of this is too big for God. He can't handle this. Well, he just gave them water from a rock. The rod of God supernaturally defeated, if you will.
I'll tell you something you'll find also if you really pay attention. Is God may give a man a mandate, but that mandate may not be fulfilled in that man's life. but he passes his own to his successor, is responsible for that mandate being fulfilled. Now, a good illustration of this is Elijah.
Yeah.
When Elijah's running from Jezebel, God appears to him when he's out there in the cave, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And he tells him, he said, "You go return and anoint Hazael to be king of Syria, anoint Jehu to be king of Israel, anoint Elisha to be prophet in your place." But do you know that he only anointed Elisha? When he threw the cloak over him. Then Elisha sent one of the young prophets to pull the oil on Jehu to anoint him king over Israel. And then later on, you see, with Ben-Hadad. But here again, the word of the Lord was fulfilled. And so often we think we have a preconceived idea how it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily happen that way. Because if you just superficially read that, you think Joshua is going to be responsible for taking out Amalek.
Right.
But he said, "You tell Joshua that that's going to occur, that he's going, I'm going to blot that name out from heaven."
Yeah.
That's an enemy of God.
And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, "Because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation."
So right there, I'll give you a little insight. So Moses builds an altar after this victory, and he names that altar Jehovah Nissi, which means "The Lord is my banner." Then the Lord declared, now listen to this, that his hand would war with Amalek from generation to generation. He didn't say it would be done in one generation. And that's exactly what you see if you continue reading through the Old Testament, that it was from one generation to another generation, then it was to be wiped out.
Chapter 18 gives insight into the legitimacy of delegated authority. The delegation of authority revealed in this chapter is often referred to as the Jethro principle. So verse 1. When Jethro the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt.
So, remember how God told Moses, I'm going to paraphrase all this, when you lead the nation of Israel out of the Egyptian bondage, you're going to bring them back to this mountain where I'm speaking to you from now, Mount Horeb,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you understand that's where God appeared to him in the burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
That's where his father-in-law was located in that area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, here they come up to Rephidim, and then later on you see they go into to the Sinai wilderness there at the foot of Horeb. Horeb is probably the mountain range. Sinai is a peak in that mountain range. There's one and the same, yet there's a distinction, if that makes sense to you. Okay? And so his father hears, man, God brought a great deliverance, you know, here with Moses, and so when he hears about this, he's ready to go out to meet him. Okay. News travels.
Verse 2. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, of which the name of one was Gershom. For he said, "I have been an alien in a strange land." And the name of the other was Eliezer. "For the God of my father," said he, "was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh."
So when Jethro goes to meet Moses, he brings Moses' wife. And that's something. Moses sent her back.
Yeah.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't in agreement with some things, so he sent her home with the kids.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to that. I'm telling you, you don't need any baggage. You don't need any disunity when you're out to do the will of God. What God's called you to do is hard enough as it is, and you sure don't need anybody working against you.
Yeah.
And nobody can work against you more than your immediate family.
Mm-hmm.
So he sends them home. So Jethro, he's bringing them back, and you get a little parenthetical here that about Moses' sons, two sons, Gershom and Eliezer. And it says that the name of Gershom, sojourner or stranger. Eliezer means God is help. And so when Moses named Gershom, he was living in a strange land. When he named Eliezer, he said, "The God of my ancestors has helped deliver me from the sword of Pharaoh." You understand? He had run from Pharaoh because his life was threatened. And so Jethro's bringing his wife and children now to meet him.
Verse 5. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God.
Now pay attention to this. It says Jethro brought Zipporah, Gershom, and Eliezer to Horeb. Right? The Mount of God. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Horeb, the Mount of God. And that's where the Israelites had set up camp there at the base of the mountain in the Sinai wilderness. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Verse 6 and 7. And he said unto Moses, "I, thy father-in-law Jethro, and come unto thee, and thy wife and her two sons with her." And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent.
So Moses gets word that his father-in-law is coming to meet him with his wife and his two sons. And so he goes out to meet his father-in-law. And when Moses comes to him, even though Moses is the leader of the nation, he bows to his father-in-law in respect, greets him with a kiss. Afterwards, they converse with one another and find out how things are going. And they went into the tent. He and his father-in-law, they're discussing this thing. Moses is rehearsing before him what God has done, the supernatural deliverance that God has wrought for the nation of Israel.
And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them.
So Moses tells Jethro how what the Lord has done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake. He also tells them about troubles that they had experienced along the way on their journey from Egypt, and how the Lord had come to their rescue. Troubles, water, food. You understand how God had provided for them supernaturally. You understand? He's telling his father-in-law, this is a miraculous God. And it has impact on Jethro. Okay?
And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians.
So when Jethro heard these things, he rejoiced because of the Lord's goodness to the descendants of Israel and the deliverance from Egypt through the Lord's intervention. I mean, he rejoices in what has occurred.
Yeah.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
He's not an Israelite.
Mm-hmm.
But he's rejoicing in the mighty God that Moses serves.
And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, For in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them.
You understand Jephthah is the priest of Midian?
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Now what's he doing? He's blessing God. He blesses the Lord who's delivered you from Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And he said, now I know that the Lord is greater than any of the gods. Because he's delivered Israel from the arrogant Egyptians who suppressed them. This has had an impact on this man. I don't know what he was serving or whatever. But I know this, that after Moses rehearses to him what all has occurred, he starts praising, blessing God. I know there's no God like this God that's delivered a nation from the bondage of another nation supernaturally. So Moses' conversation had great impact on his father-in-law.
Yeah.
Well, time's up, so we'll stop and take a break here.
Okay.